This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. There was no way Chuck Liddy was going to follow in his father's footsteps into the military. He had way too much attitude, and he liked to push the limits. But when Chuck started pushing to see how much he could do with a camera and a makeshift darkroom, he discovered a talent that turned into a lifelong passion. Chuck became a photojournalist and quickly worked his way up to bigger and bigger news outlets, while his images were picked up by the Associated Press and sent around the world. Chuck went around the world, too, to cover wars and natural disasters. But he always came back to his home base at the News and Observer, where he spent more than 20 years and made some of the most memorable local pictures of the last few decades. Chuck Liddy is my guest today. Chuck Liddy, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Hey, thanks, Frank. Appreciate it.
Tell us how this all started out. You didn't grow up in North Carolina, right?
No, but I've lived here most of my life because my dad was in the Marines, and he was stationed in North Carolina several times. But he retired down in Florida, North Florida. And I came up here on vacation after shooting pictures for a couple of years for a small newspaper in North Florida and fell in love with North Carolina and came up here and started trying to get a job.
Kind of interesting because I understand your dad really recommended that you not go into the military.
Yeah.
But also it was his camera that got you into the career that you did follow.
Right. So he had a camera that he used when he was in Vietnam. He was with a Marine helicopter squadron and north of Da Nang, and he had this camera and he brought it back, and I started using it after I got out of high school to mess around and get into football games with, and developed my own film and used it, and then the small paper there liked the stuff I shot and asked me if I wanted to come and work for him the next year.
Well, let's talk more about that, getting into the football games. How'd that work?
Well, you know, you have your friends are behind you, and I played football poorly, I might add, but I played football, and my brother was on the team and a lot of my best friends, and so I wanted to go see him the next year, and I wasn't going to college. I was, working odd jobs and such, and somebody said, hey, you can get in the game free if you have a camera. So I said, hey, Dad, can I borrow the camera? And he says, yeah. So I took it. They let me in. I started shooting pictures with it. Guy comes up and asks me if the pictures are any good. And, of course, being, 19 years old, I'm like, oh, yeah, they're great. they were really horrible. Mm-hmm. But they started using the pictures.
Yeah, who's the guy who asked you?
He was the writer for the local paper that did the high school sports.
But this is interesting. So you've left high school, but you weren't doing any photography at the time. The only reason you picked up that camera was to get into the games, or had you been using it a little bit before then?
I'd been using it a little bit, but not much. I mean, because I hadn't really gotten into the darkroom stuff yet.
And so you start taking some pictures. You tell this guy, yeah, it's great, which I think takes us to the other part of the story, and that is your father's advice that perhaps you should not consider the military.
My dad's pretty much exact quote was, you can't go in the Marines because you will be buried in a swamp at Paris Island.
This is
by the drill sergeants.
And why did he think this would be true?
I guess I had an attitude problem.
I see.
I didn't take orders very well.
All right. So he picks up on this right away. This is a little bit of a, first of all, you're not a big guy. You were playing football, so I'm guessing you're kind of scrappy and had your own way of inflicting pain.
I was pretty much the smallest guy on the football team.
Yeah.
So.
So you're mouthy, you're scrappy. Right? Am I getting close?
That's probably...
Am I close?
That's probably a good assessment. You could ask a couple of my bosses, ex-bosses, about that.
I talked to your colleague, Jay Price.
Oh,
Jay
Price.
He pretty much confirms that.
Yeah. Well, Jay, he'll say yes to almost anything.
We'll get to that in a minute. Okay, so here you are. I'm taking these pictures. I'm 19 years old. A guy from the paper comes, says, how are they? You're saying they're great. Take a look. But it turns out they had to be pretty good because he used them, right?
Well, you got to remember, this is back in 1973, late 1973, the fall football season. And no, they weren't that great. They were pretty awful. I have had to look back at them and go, oh, God, these are awful.
Yeah.
I mean, I was using flash bulbs. I mean, flash bulbs, not an electronic flash, but I was using flash bulbs. Like, you shoot one picture, the flash bulb has to come out, you put another one in.
Yeah, and leave them all over the field. But I understand that at a certain point, you had developed a signaling system with the quarterback.
Yeah, he's my best friend.
Yeah.
And he would come out of the huddle, and he would let me know which way the play was going by either a hand motion or a nod of his head or whatever. So I would just, if it was going the other way, I wouldn't even put the camera up to my face.
This is going to cost you a flashbulb, so you got to be a little more circumspect and thoughtful about this. But also, wasn't that something else that this editor or this guy from the papers sort of began to notice, how you were fortuitously anticipating when the play was coming in your direction?
That's the writer covered the games from down on the field, and he's the one that, him and another photographer from the bigger paper noticed it. And they were like, how do you always know which way the play's going? And I said, oh, I played football with these guys, and I can tell what they're going to do as soon as they come out of the huddle. But I didn't tell anybody that Jimmy was giving me the signals.
at a certain point, though, these photographs got a little bit better, and other newspapers began to notice.
I got better gear since I lived, near a Navy base. These guys would come back from overseas, and they, in the want ads, which nobody has anymore, they would advertise stuff, and I was down at the beach was only 30 miles away. So
this is
I was,
in Florida, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was down at the beach surfing one day, and I was looking at the want ads because there was a lightning storm came up, and there was an ad for this camera gear, and I couldn't believe it was right. And I slung the surfboard in the car and got to a payphone and called this guy up, and the price was right on all this gear he was selling. It was brand new. So I drove all the way back to Jacksonville, which is like 45 miles, wow, right to this guy's house, and wrote him a check for the drained my bank account to buy this gear. And that's what's really started it.
And you also, by this time, had you built your own darkroom in the bathroom?
Yeah, I could. It wasn't in there all the time. I used the sink to develop the film. The trays to make the prints were in the bathtub, and the enlarger sat on the toilet.
Well, then good that it wasn't there the whole time.
Exactly, because, I was still living at home, and there probably would have been some problems.
Yeah, and your dad's an ex-Marine, so,
exactly.
I'm with you there. Now, is this the point at what point do you decide, wait a minute, this could actually be a career?
When they called me back the next year, and they asked me if I wanted a full-time job, the guy that had bought the paper, his family owned the St. Augustine Record, which was a very good medium-sized newspaper, and they had tons of money, and he had built a new building, which was only a mile from my house, and I had no idea, but he built a new building with a state-of-the-art darkroom in it and state-of-the-art presses, and I mean, they spent a lot of money on it. And when they asked me if I wanted to work there, I was, sure.
Did you know all that would involve? I mean, this is now, it's not only photo, it's photojournalism, so it's not just taking pictures.
No, but there was a guy there that was one of the editors who had been a photographer in Tampa, a news photographer in Tampa, and he kind of showed me the way. And I just had a good eye for it, and I would read books, and I read a lot. And I'd read a lot coming up, my whole lot. I'd been reading a lot since I was a kid, and I knew how to write. So I could write my captions with no problems as soon as I knew what the caption style was supposed to be. And then I started writing stories.
Yeah, at a certain point, talk about that. It was like, can you take a picture and can you write the story?
Right. So I did that. And then when we started spreading out, covering stuff more, I would cover the game and shoot the stories. And then if I found something interesting in the community, I would do a feature story or whatever. And sometimes I did new stuff.
I was going to ask you, was it all sports in the beginning? And
it was pretty much all sports, and then it just shifted really quick.
And what kind of stuff, when you're doing news then, what kind of things were you covering?
I would go to rallies, and I got to go cover Carter's inauguration, Jimmy Carter's inauguration in D.C. And a guy in our county was a good buddy with Jimmy Carter, so he had arranged to get the press credentials for our boss. And I was on the inaugural stand with everybody else, which was crazy.
How old were you then?
When Carter was inaugurated? Yeah. I guess that was, 70? 5, I think. I'm not sure. I can't remember. I'd have to look
really,
at it.
Really early in your career. Then what brought you to North Carolina?
I came up here on vacation and was in the mountains, and I fell in love with the mountains. It was, the leaves were changing, and I was like, oh, my God, I got to live here. Mm-hmm. So I went back home, took another week's vacation, and came up and looked around and found a job soon after.
That was in Hickory?
It was near Hickory, a little town called Eichard, which is on, you'll see it on I-40 if you go by, and if you, but if you blink, you're going to miss it because it's an exit. And another rich guy had started a weekly newspaper, and he was looking for a sports writer and a photographer. And he had state-of-the-art presses and some new stuff called computers. And I said, yeah, and I came up and started doing that.
Left those flash bulbs behind. My guest is photojournalist Chuck Liddy. Spent more than 2 decades with the News and Observer, and just ahead we'll talk about some of Chuck's biggest assignments and how he created those unforgettable images. We'll talk about it on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking to Chuck Liddy today. Used a little trickery to get his start in the photojournalism business, but he had one thing going for him. He was not lying about his pictures. They are truly good. So good that he ended up filing stories around the world for Associated Press and, of course, working for the News and Observer for more than 2 decades. Covered everything from basketball rivalries to earthquakes and war. Well, now talk about those early days in Hickory. What were you doing there?
I covered high school football and just things that happened around in Burke County, pretty much. And then after a year and a half at the small weekly, the daily paper in Morganton called me and they wanted me to come work with them. And so that was a daily paper. It was a very well thought of small newspaper in North Carolina. It was where Senator Sam lived, and they had a good circulation for, you know, and it was going to be better assignments.
Of course, you're talking about Sam Ervin, and this would have been in the Watergate years, right, or just a little after?
I think
after.
It was after that. Yeah, it was after the Watergate years.
Yeah. So were you at this point imagining a career for yourself? Were you seeing yourself going kind of from market to market or more like living day
yes,
to day?
Yes, I was. That happened when after I'd been at the News Herald for a few months, and my boss came up and said, the Associated Press just called us and they've been looking at your pictures because they get the paper every day. They've been looking at your stuff and they want to put a transmission station in the paper, which was a really big deal because there's only one transmission station in Western North Carolina, and that was in Asheville. So they were going to put and the editor and the publisher and everybody was like freaking out because they were like, oh, this is so great. So I started filing pictures to the wire every day.
Now, what kind of things, because you're in Western North Carolina, there's a lot going on there, but for the Associated Press, they've got obviously national and international distribution. So what was it that you were doing that they felt they could distribute internationally?
Well, back in the day when newspapers used things called standalone feature pictures, everybody needed one every day. Some papers needed 2 or 3 every day. And I was really good at finding stuff like that. And then I would find events that were happening nearby that I could drive to. And of course, if the AP was going to use them, we're going to use them. So our bosses were really happy that my stuff was getting used by the AP.
So what would that be? Give us an example of that.
Oh, I don't know. You know, when the leaves change color, I'd go up and shoot people, you know, doing the leaf stuff. There were several times back then, and I guess it still happens now, that the parkway would get jacked up. I mean, it'd be a traffic jam for miles and miles. And so I'd shoot things like that. We had an enormous amount of weird crashes, car crashes and fires and things like that in Burke County. And then when big things started happening, the biggest thing that happened was that started it off was a bunch of prisoners took over the West Jefferson Jail, which was about 60 miles from Morganton. And they called me up and they said, we need you to get over there and we need you to transmit some pictures. And I'm like, how am I going to do that? Because the transmission machine weighed 60 pounds. So they told me what to do, which was take it apart, take the thing away from the wall and unplug the lines and put it in my car.
Mm-hmm.
So I put it in the front seat and seat belted the thing in the front seat, and I drove to West Jefferson, and I shot some pictures with a telephoto lens, I remember, and put them on, got them on the wire, and they were all happy because it was, you know, it was a, you know, picture of cops with guns, which they wanted.
But in a remote area, so otherwise it would have been pretty difficult for them to get. And I guess you had to then plug the thing into a phone line.
Well, you had to, you know, I already knew how to do that kind of stuff because I was always really good at trying to keep up with technology on how this, what stuff I needed to use, how it would work. And I'd been shown several ways how to get payphone, how to use payphones, take the mouthpiece off the payphones and hook up the alligator clips. So, and then the AP photographer from Raleigh showed up the next morning, and his name was Bob Jordan, and he's kind of a legend in North Carolina, and he's the, he mentored me. He's the one that, like, put me on a path, and it was after that stuff happened that I was like, oh, this is it. I'm not doing anything else.
And it also was a path that led you to the Triangle. Talk about that transition.
I came over here a lot for the AP, covering. I covered when the Dean Smith Center opened. I covered that game, and I covered some football games when Reagan came to North Carolina State. I covered that, and then they were calling me up to come to the coast to do storms and work on the AP team at storms.
The first one was Gloria, right?
That was Gloria was the first one they called me for.
Yeah. Talk about covering that, because at the time I think that was the biggest storm that had ever hit the East Coast or something like that. It broke some records.
It was pretty crazy because I lived in Morganton, which is, you know, 20 miles from Hickory, and they called me and they said, we need you to get to Wilmington to cover this storm. And I said, okay. So I took off to go to Wilmington, and it took, back then it took 6 or 7 hours, I think, to get to Wilmington from there, because their 40 wasn't finished down to Wilmington, so there were, you know, it was not easy to get there. I got to Wilmington, there was nothing much going on. They put me in a hotel down by the water, and I was exhausted, so they said, get some sleep. So I went to bed, and the phone woke me up, and I answered it, and the boss, the AP guy, Ambrose Dudley, goes, Chuck, you get some rest? And I said, yeah, I feel great. And he goes, we need you to go to Manio. And I went, where's Manio? And, you know, Manio was like 4 hours away, four or five hours away from Wilmington. And the storm was coming in. And I said, okay, well, I feel great. I'll take a shower and get going. Well, I got up and I looked at the clock and I'd only been asleep for an hour. So I jumped in the car, the truck. I had a four-wheel drive, and I jumped in the truck and I started driving. And the storm was coming in. So I'm driving through torrential rains. I hit a flooded road and almost wreck. I keep going. I get up towards Manio, and there's this really, really weird light in the sky over towards the, across the bridge. And I'm on top of the bridge, and it gets real bright, and then it gets real dim, and real bright, and real dim. And I'm going, what in the hell is that? I said, oh, the electricity must be coming on and off because of the high winds, because the wind's blowing 40 or 50 miles an hour. Yeah. Well, I get into Manio, and there's power lines and trees down, and I'm driving around everything, and I come around a corner and the light gets really bright and I go, oh my God. And the Ace Hardware, that it's still there, but it's different now. But the Ace Hardware was on fire. And all the, that's where they sold ammunition in there, paints, everything. And the flames were going across the three-lane road. And I jumped out of the truck and I started shooting pictures. And I got this picture of these firemen silhouetted with the flames going all the way across the three-lane road. And I shot it, and then the sun came up because it was getting close to light. Sun came up, and the flooding started. Firefighter told me if I didn't want to stay in Manio, I better get out of there because the water was coming in from the sound, and it was going to flood everything. So I shot some flooding pictures, jumped in a car, and started driving to Elizabeth City to transmit. I drove through the highest water I've ever driven through, which I have never done again. The water was coming over the hood almost, and got to Elizabeth City and sent the pictures. And when Bob Jordan got back, he had been out in Nag's Head because there was no big bridges back then. He had to go through the north end. And he came back and he goes, I was asleep. I was sleeping on the floor in Elizabeth City newspaper's photo department. And he woke me up and he goes, like, what the hell is everybody raising hell about this picture for? What is this picture? And I went, what picture? And he goes, this fire picture. They're going crazy in New York over it. They're saying it's a great picture. And I went, it's laying over there, Bob. And he went and picked it up, and he goes, like, this is the weirdest hurricane picture I've ever seen. And I said, well, you know, I shot what I saw, and I sent some flooding pictures, too.
We got some file stuff in there if you want to get some from 1984. Talk about the, but talk about that, the because people accuse, maybe it's an accusation, maybe it's not, maybe it's a boast, but for journalists, particularly photojournalists, of being adrenaline junkies. Had you done much of that kind of stuff before? Was this the first time you were really having to risk your life to do these things?
That was the first time I did anything really stupid and dangerous. But, I mean, I'd gotten lots of bad wrecks starting in Florida, and, I mean, I always got to be, because I worked in small communities, all the cops and all the firefighters knew me and the highway patrolmen knew me. And at one of the papers I was at, two of the papers I was at, the cops wanted me to shoot evidence photos a lot of times. And we got special access to scenes, which the bosses loved. And things are different now. You can't do that kind of stuff anymore. But back then, at a small paper, it was the bosses loved the access, but I saw some really horrible, horrible things. Yeah. And, but yeah, I could drive. Like, I went to a one wreck once and they told me to get there as fast as I could. It was 1 o'clock in the morning and I was going like 90 miles an hour and I passed a cop and he just waved to me. So
is there something about, I mean, it's one thing to say, well, I got to do that for the job, but do you become addicted to that? Is that part of the rush for you and part of the passion?
I think part of it was I just enjoyed it so much. Yeah. I mean, I didn't enjoy going and seeing these terrible things, but I enjoyed being like right there at things. I enjoyed being able to take places that they can't go or they maybe never be able to go, and they might not want to go, but they need to see it.
And you talked about the fact that while it's difficult to see, there was a point very early in your career where you did kind of revel in the possibility of these, and you were put straight by someone who worked at a paper.
Yeah, I was young, and it was kind of typical. You'd come back from something, and so that was really great. Or that was terrific. That was crazy good. And I came back one day after going to a terrible car wreck. And, you know, it's really funny. Car wrecks are different now because all the safety stuff. But back in the 70s, nobody wore seatbelts. And if there was a head-on collision, there was going to be some dead people. And I came back from a bad wreck. I think two people died. And I came running in the newsroom, and it was just before deadline, so I had to get going. I ran through, and the editor went, how was it? And I said, it was great. And I ran in the dark room. And I came out after getting the pictures to the people that needed them to get them back to the camera room to shoot for the press. The lady up front, the receptionist, said, Chuck, come here. And I said, yeah, what's up? And she goes, you know, you really should be careful when you say that something was great when it involves some people dying. It doesn't look good. It doesn't make you look good. And if you think about it, it's just not something good to say. And I was like, oh, wow. And I had never thought about it. And I tried never to say that stuff again. I might say I got a great picture out of it, or I got a really good photo, but I never said it was great, meaning like what had happened was great.
Does that put up a big, because I would think at a certain point this happens for all great professionals, where particularly when you're young, you realize the opportunity here. This is going to be a great photo. It's going to be a compelling photo, at the very least. And then at some point you have to put up this wall and say, this is a tragic event that involves people, and it will also offer you the opportunity to go someplace, you, the viewer, reader, to go somewhere. Is that a wall that sort of grows and matures as you mature as a professional?
Yeah, that's a pretty good way to describe it, because I've always felt like if I'm behind the camera, one, I can't be hurt, and two, I'm not really seeing what I'm seeing. Hmm. It's hard to explain. I saw some really horrific things, and I always thought the only thing that pretty much saved me from being like crazy was that it was the camera. So
you were embedded with the 82nd Airborne Division in Fallujah during the Iraq War. Talk about that experience.
I enjoyed all my military assignments. I started getting military assignments when I was in Florida because we were right next to the big Navy base, the air station, Jacksonville Naval Air Station. And I always got, and of course, my dad was in the Marines, so, you know, he always had his buddies were over at the house. And when I grew up, I was always hanging out with, he would take me to the air station and, you know, hang out with the helicopter guys. And I just always, I had a great affinity towards the military. I did not want to be in the military, but I had a great affinity for them and towards them. And I got along with the troops really well. I mean, one of the things that the enlisted guys liked about me so much is that I kind of like I usually did, and why I would be dead if I had been in the military was I would tell officers that they couldn't tell me what to do because I was not a soldier. And then I'd remind some of them that, you know what my rank is, right? Because everybody has a rank. Even a civilian has a rank when you're embedded. And we were majors.
How'd that happen?
You have to have what's it called?
They got some kind of standard operating procedure.
For a transit, you have to have a name and a right. rank for the transit.
Okay, I get that, but I mean major, that's a...
Yeah, major.
Especially since they weren't that particularly enamored with the meat. I would think there'd be a tense relationship.
There was, and I mean, I had a captain yelling at me once. He was an intelligence guy, and he was yelling at us in a tent once, and it was Jay and I, Jay Price. And I said, you know I'm a major, right? And he said, yeah. And I said, so you're a captain, and, you know, you're below me, so stop yelling at me. Yeah. And I just walked off, and half the soldiers in the tent had heard it, and they thought the guy was a jerk. And
yeah, but when they got guns.
Yeah.
So talk about that, because Jay Price, of course, worked for the NNO, and you two worked together.
Right.
And I wish you could have heard. Now I'm addressing our listeners. I wish all of you could have heard the conversation in the green room, because that was the radio show. 90% of it would have been bleeped out, but that was the radio show I wanted to hear. But Jay mentioned something that we didn't know, I think, before, that you got a great shot of a tank when you were standing on a wall. The thing was that your job was to get a picture of the tank. And as I understand it, the tank's job was to knock down the wall on which you were standing.
I just had to move. I moved when I saw it coming, and it was really stupid. It was a stupid thing to do.
Talk about your mindset, though, in an environment like that. It's a dangerous environment, and it seems to me you have to have a different framework, a different way of thinking about yourself, your mortality, and your role. Do you? I mean, are you more inclined to take risks in that situation?
I don't know. How other photographers, I've never really talked to, you don't really talk to guys about this because no one ever really discusses it because I know two really great photographers who were killed, and Chris Andros and David Gilkey. And, you know, if you think about dying, you're not going to be able to do your job. I mean, that's what I've always told people. They go, how did you do that? And it's like, and if you are worried about your mortality, you are not going to be able to do your job. You have to just put it out of your mind. And the way I've always looked at stuff after all the terrible things I've covered, shootings, fires, car wrecks, plane crashes, hurricanes, you know, everything, I just always go, you're never guaranteed of anything. And they wanted to send me overseas. The paper wanted to send me overseas. I thought it was a great opportunity. I said I would do it, and I wasn't going to be going, you know, oh, no, I'm going to get hurt, I'm going to die, or anything like that. So you just kind of if you're going to think about it, You shouldn't be there.
My guest is Chuck Liddy. He spent more than two decades as a photojournalist with the News and Observer, and just ahead we'll talk about some technological changes and some of the other events and stories that he has covered in his career, and we'll talk about that on The State of Things. I invite you to stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and if you have lived in North Carolina for a while, you may remember some of Chuck Liddy's photographs. They appeared in the News and Observer for more than two decades and in media outlets around the world. Chuck's photos have been capturing some of the most important events of our day, from wars in Afghanistan and Iraq to hurricanes and basketball games here at home. We're talking about doing war coverage and being embedded. You know, and earlier you talked, very early in your career in Florida, you have special access. Police are letting you in because you're giving them evidentiary photographs in return. But these relationships, how do you navigate this? Because on the one hand, it does give you special access, and we all want that. And on the other hand, we know now you have to have a special relationship with the people you're covering. How do you navigate that?
Well, things changed with the later in the timeline of my work. And then when I started working for the NNO, you know, things are really different at that level of the Herald Sun and the NNO and big papers. And you don't do things that you did with small papers, like, you know, sharing photos with the police and things like that. So, but with the military, you know, we had a set of ground rules, and these guys knew that I was going to follow the ground rules. I mean, I signed a paper that said there were certain things you couldn't do. I'm not going to put anybody in danger, because it's just like when I covered, you know, disasters and stuff, you don't want to do something to make yourself part of the problem. And, you know, when they told me to do something as far as like where not to go or where not to step or what not to do, I did it. And, you know, they respect that because they, you know, they've had other embeds before, and you'd always hear a story about somebody, some nitwit, who had done something that pissed them all off because they put them in danger. And
well, I can imagine you not wanting to do that. But the other side of it is you've been in mortal danger with this group of people. Does it get difficult to do the hard news, to cover the hard news, or send back the unflattering photograph?
Was it hard for me to do that? No. The soldiers actually, when they saw my pictures, because, you know, some of them would come by to look at the computer and say, hey, what did you get of that? And I shot a picture. We were on the QRF, the Quick Response Force, after we actually heard it. We were riding around with these guys, and this was near Fallujah, and there was a very, very loud explosion. And everybody was like going, what was that? And then the radio started going off. And we went back to the base. And as soon as we got to the base, all these guys are, they're arming up and starting to jump in their Humvees. And we had a very good relationship with the captain of that unit. And I knew where his Jeep was. And I heard the kids yelling. I call them kids because I was the oldest guy there. I mean, that was weird too. I mean, I was older than most of the officers. And I heard the kids going like, it's a quick response, you know, force thing, QRF, and we got to go. There's been a bombing. And I just grabbed my stuff and ran and jumped in the captain's Jeep. And he came out and he goes, you ready to go? And I said, yep. And, you know, Jay jumps in and we take off. And we pass a whole group of media on this looked like Interstate 40. It just looked like an interstate.
Wow.
And we passed a whole group of media trying to get up the ramp, but it was blocked. And we just went around them, and they don't know that we're the media with these guys. But, you know, there's like 20 of them, and we just keep going. It turns out that a Humvee had been totally destroyed, and one soldier was killed, one was injured, and one guy got his foot blown off. And we pulled up, and the thing was still smoking and burning. And I jumped out, and I noticed that there was a boot laying on the ground. And I was, holy crap, that's crazy. And I ran over, and I didn't think I was going to be able to get this picture, because I figured someone would yell at me to stop. But we had good relations with everybody. and I shot a bunch of pictures of this boot with the smoldering Humvee in the background with the guys trying to put the fire out. And I just didn't want to look in the boot because I was afraid there was a foot in it. There wasn't. But I got these really pretty good pictures, and everybody wanted to see them. The guys who had not been the guys at the base wanted to see all the pictures when I came back to see what the Humvee had looked like. And that ended up running a double truck in Time Magazine a few months later.
It's a big spread. So you've covered those events. You were in those circumstances. And I understand that it was really the trip to Haiti in the aftermath of the earthquake that you found most troubling.
Yeah. I saw some really, really, of all the horrible things I've seen, it was pretty bad.
You're tearing up now, and I won't ask you to relive it, but I wonder if you've thought about what it is that made that more difficult for you.
It was kids. It was just horrible. And then I saw that guy that I had been when I was a kid, and the situation I was in, where I went around this corner and there were bodies stacked up everywhere, and it was like horrible and shocking. And I just said, I'm not taking a picture of this, because there had been pictures been taken of it all, that kind of stuff already. And I said, no, I gotta make one picture just to show how horrible this is, and nobody will ever use it because it's horrible. And I made this picture, and then there's this young guy. He had a mask over his face because it smelled horrible, obviously. And he was yelling, oh, man, this is some great, you know, this is great. This is unbelievable. Are you getting this? This is unbelievable. And I was going, oh, man, now I know why that lady said that to me back then.
Did you say something?
I just shook my head and walked off.
Did it affect you? I mean, obviously, you were deeply mindful of the kind of photos you were going to take then. Did it affect you after that?
Yeah, I started having some problems, and I ended up talking to our HR people and telling them that I was having some bad problems. And I had an incident where I came out of an assignment one day here in Raleigh, and I live in Durham, and I came out of my, I just sat, got in my truck, and I couldn't move. I felt like I was paralyzed, and I kind of freaked out and went home. And I don't even remember going home. I just got home, but that was the first real incident I had. And I talked to my doctor, and I talked to some other people, and they said that they thought I was suffering from PTSD, and I needed to see somebody. So there was only one doctor in this whole area, believe it or not, that was a PTSD doctor. Yeah. And I went and saw her, and I saw her for a couple of years, and she fixed me. Yeah. I mean, she fixed it, and I'm much better now. That, and with the help of my beautiful wife, Angela Burns.
Did you think you were not going to take photos again?
I was more concerned about my mental health. I didn't worry about taking pictures because I continued to take photos in Haiti after that happened. I made some really nice photos after. I mean, they weren't horrible photos. They just showed what it was like. But the therapist told me that PTSD, and this is why it's so bad for soldiers and firefighters and police officers, is because it's like a building block thing. It keeps building and building. It's not just usually one event. And she told me that it wasn't just what happened in Haiti. She said it was the cumulative effect of all the bad things over all the years. And that was just a huge trigger. So,
you know, we talk about it certainly for first responders and for and obviously for people in battle, for military, but then anybody who's having to deal with that. So that can be medical professionals, right, and even teachers who are seeing this stuff come to them every day. I mean, I think we don't think enough about
how
people are on the front lines, and you talked about this being a cumulative effect, and we're all out there trying to do our professions, absorbing horror and trauma we can't do anything about.
Yeah, you can't. You can't unsee something. Yeah. I mean, that's just how it is, and that's why I can't look at that picture I shot. And I have looked at the take. I've gone and opened up I have the disc with all the stuff on it, and I've gone back, and I feel pretty good about the fact that I told myself I was going to make this one photo, and I made that one photo, and I left the rest of the stuff that was there. I didn't make a photo of it. And, you know, some people say, like, well, you know, what the hell good are you if you couldn't do that? Mm-hmm. And I just go, I've been doing it a long time, and that was what I consider to be a moral decision on my part, that I'm not a vulture. A lot of people think that photojournalists are vultures and, you know, we don't have any feelings. Well, we do have feelings, and a lot of us pay for the bad things we've seen by stuff that happened to me with the PTSD. And then there's a lot of photographers that pay more than that. There's been a lot of suicides in this profession, but there's been a whole lot of good photographers, great photographers, who end up, you know, giving their life trying to document stuff so the public and regular people can see stuff that they can't physically ever be at.
And I think we can tell the difference, too, those of us who are not taking those photos, between photographers who mean to capture the humanity of a horrific situation and those who mean to capture only the horror. Is that something that you become conscious of, that sort of seeing through the horror? Because it seems to me you can frame this either way, as a horrific spectacle, or find the way to frame this shot that shows you, takes you deep inside the humanity.
The Haiti trip to me did that opened my eyes. The overseas stuff opened my eyes more to stuff like that, because I spent more time looking in Haiti. I spent more time looking for photos of people dealing with the tragedy, you know, but trying to frame it so you could see the physical damage to the infrastructure and the buildings, but have people,
yeah,
you know, and not have, you know, dead bodies laying around or things like that. And I actually, that was one of the things I really loved about the trips to Afghanistan and Iraq, is that every time I went, I tried to do something different with pictures, and I ended up starting to try to do more things showing the people. And the last time we were in Afghanistan, we ended up doing a lot of stuff not with the military, which was great, because we were in Kabul, and we did several different stories in Kabul of just people stuff.
You talked about the very earliest days when you had to change flash bulbs between shots. The technology sure has come a long way. Is that for better or for worse in this industry?
Oh, it's great. I mean, and plus, for someone like me who wanted the instant gratification, that's why I started developing my own film. Digital was a dream come true. And we had used digital cameras at the News and Observer, but they were very expensive. They took horrible pictures. I told you a while ago that your cell phone will take a 35-meg picture now, right? The first digital cameras would cost $25,000, shot a 1-meg picture. And they were terrible files. I mean, they were horrible files. And yeah, it's been great. I was the first one at the News and Observer who the boss was trying to get someone who wanted to be the first all digital photographer, because the cameras were getting better, and no one wanted to do it. And we had a pretty huge staff back then. This was in 2000, and I said, "Oh, I'll be glad to do it." Because I would love to see the pictures as soon as I shot them.
Why wait?
Yeah.
Well, also, and one of the first drone pilots, right? You were using drones very early on.
Yeah.
Not the first.
Yeah, I bought my own drone and started using it. And we couldn't use any of the stuff in the for the company because McClatchy had an anti-drone policy at that point or whatever. I don't know exactly what the deal was on that, but then they finally saw the light. But I've been flying my drone for a year, so I was good with it. And
you know, as you were just trying to find the words to describe McClatchy's policy, and I looked into your eyes, and I think I saw what Jay Price was talking about with your, with respect to your attitude towards senior management. That's all I'm going to say at this moment. I just want to say that. But what about the industry, though? Okay, it's easier for photographers, better. You're an early adapter, and you've used it very well. But the fact that we all have these highly advanced picture takers in our pocket has certainly changed the way we view media, and it's obviously changed media itself, the business. Are you worried about the way we're going? With everybody as a reporter and everybody as a photographer, not much vetting, not much editing?
I worry a lot about, I kind of made a little complaints about this. There's a, you know, the whole Photoshop thing and doctoring pictures. Well, we're not allowed to do that. We're allowed to tone pictures and, you know, crop them and that kind of thing. And there's people out there that are really good with Photoshop and do stuff, crazy stuff to photos. And there's a guy on the Outer Banks that he's not a journalist, but he posts these pictures and he, all the time, and they're outrageous, but people believe that they're real pictures, like a 40-foot wave at the Outer Banks, or, you know, a whale, like a gigantic whale that's not really there. Think, you know, just silly things like that. And, you know, that's what he does. And then we were running stories about this guy because it was, you know, like it was a news thing. Well, to me, you're just giving publicity to somebody that's doing something that's fake. And, I mean, purporting to say that it's because it's fake you're doing the story is that doesn't pass the test for me. So
Chuck Liddy, well, the next time we got to get you and Jay Price to do a podcast where you can say whatever you want, because that would have been the show, but I did the best I could. And I deeply appreciate talking to you, Chuck Liddy. What a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Chuck Liddy, photojournalist. You can find out more about his work and our show at our website, stateofthings.org. You can also sign up for our newsletter and get a daily preview of our lineup. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley's our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.